Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, with the participation and assistance of the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association, we're talking about the evolving world of labor and employment law. You're ready to move on from your job. That is, until your employer says you can't work in that industry, that you signed an agreement never to work for a competitor. The law surrounding non-compete agreements is changing, and it's also very interesting. Just what is a non-compete agreement? To what extent can an employer prevent a former employee from working in the industry, or with a competitor, locally, or maybe not locally? And as always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking about non-compete agreements. We're talking labor and employment law. Point being, you don't have to jump in at the exact point we may be in our conversation. But do bear in mind that our guest can't provide you precise legal advice. We don't have all the facts relating to your case. But we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision making. And the guidance provided mightn't be the same positions of their respective employers or clients, but again, my guests tonight are here to help. And who are those guests? Well, joining us tonight, a partner in the firm Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo, Thomas Lenz handles all aspects of labor and employment law issues and heads the firm's traditional labor and national labor relations board practices. He works with employers in all major industries across California and the West. Also joining us tonight, Beth W. Mora of Mora Employment Law is dedicated to representing victimized employees. She is a passionate and accomplished advocate for those facing a wide range of employment law issues. Beth's commitment to social justice and volunteerism is deeply rooted in her personal values. And due to her advocacy, Beth is often invited to speak, has published numerous articles, as well as been quoted in legal journals, including Bloomberg Law, Daily Journal, and Law 360, on issues impacting employees and the legal community. From the courthouse to the boardroom, Beth is a committed advocate for her clients and her community. And Beth, Tom, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
You know, I'd like to start out with a very basic question. What is a non-compete agreement?
It's up to you, Tom. I can let you field this one, or I can give you my short answer and let you have the fun answer.
Go for it, Beth.
So as a plaintiff's employment attorney, I believe a non-compete agreement is a shackle. It's an improper attempt by an employer to limit an employee's ability to work. That's my perception, and that's how I look at them. But there's actually a legal definition as well. Do you want to hit the legal definition, Tom?
Well, I'll throw some perspective out there. I think from an employer's point of view, a non-compete agreement is a method, an agreement which is intended to limit where someone is able to perform their services. It might provide some limits and definitions on, you know, what they're not allowed to do and when and where they're not allowed to do it. So it's a way that is going to maybe keep you from plying your trade in certain places, times, certainly something that has created some big issues in California and nationally.
You know, it seems to me, and I'm not in the field, but it seems to me that it starts out as a fairly reasonable idea that's subject to tremendous abuse. And the real question, I would think, is just as these agreements are supposed to put up, supposed to draw some lines, maybe it should draw some lines with the drafters. But how do you feel about that, Beth?
Well, you're right. Originally, we see non-competition agreements starting in the concept of an employer has a right to protect their trade secrets. Who can disagree with that? No one. An employer has a right to protect their confidential information. Who can disagree with that? No one. Those still hold true today. But non-competition agreements have started to eke into limiting the ability to work in your trade and profession, a geographic range from where you live and work, forcing people to move, time and space, how long. So a year from your last day of work, months, 2 years, that type of thing. And those, working with any of the clients you worked with, limiting any of the clients you last worked with, the employment, or limiting any employees you last worked with, soliciting any clients, soliciting any former employees. So these types of restrictions are the things that you're now seeing very clearly that the law is saying, no, it's not enforceable. No, you can't have those restrictions. And they had said those before, but because those restrictions kept showing up in workplace documents, the law reinforced that you can't limit in a person's ability to find work and be a profiting member of society. It was hurting not just that individual, it was hurting society at large.
But ultimately, within reasonable boundaries, you don't want taking everything that you know with them and going to one of your competitors. What's a reasonable restriction on that?
Go ahead, Tom.
I think that, you know, what is reasonable depends on, you know, what is unique to you and what do you regard as being truly confidential. If there's, you know, a client list, if there's, you know, something that is unique to how you serve your customers and your processes, and you have that under lock and key, or it's something that's, you know, password protected and only allowed to, you know, the topmost people in the company. Yeah, those are the things that are, you know, the things that can be typically limited. But, you know, if you're a computer programmer or if you are, you know, drafting software and there's nothing particularly unique to, you know, what you do compared to other people at other companies, you know, you should be able to apply your trade and make a living. It's, I know a lot of employers are very eager to try to claim many things are confidential, and I hear that a lot. And what is truly confidential? What is really unique to you?
Right. And so, sorry, Jeff.
Go ahead.
It's really easy to see if I own, let's say, a car dealership, and I print out every customer that the dealership has had that last year. And then go take that customer list to another car dealership, hypothetically, not identifying any case or car dealership, that employee could leave and have a problem. That is very much going to be something that the law still very much has the right to enforce, gives former employers the right to enforce. But if that employee leaves the car dealership, goes and works in another one in the same geographic region, and a former customer finds them, and says, oh, geez, you're now selling Acuras. You were selling, you know, Nissans. I want to work with you now. That former employer doesn't have a right to limit their ability to sell to the former customer at their new dealership.
So if somebody leaves their Lexus dealership in Redwood City and goes to work at a Lexus dealer in Serramonte, starts reaching out to his clients, he may find that he's got a bit of a problem.
But maybe, especially if he's using contact information he obtained at the last employer. That's information he obtained through the last employer. That's their data.
But maybe less so if he's doing in-house stuff for an Acura dealer or some other manufacturer. Not taking leads, taking in-house calls, that kind of thing.
Ah, correct.
So what's going on lately that's really brought these issues to the surface more than it has in the past? Have there been changes in the law or changes in what people are doing with them?
There's a couple of things. Non-competition agreements have been very clearly under the law, unenforceable in California for many years. And Tom, I think you were just going to address that, really, if you wanted to dig into that.
California has forbidden non-competes for decades. And it's something that is very broad. Some other states have followed suit, but it's basically from the Business and Professions Code here in California, section 16600. If you are keeping score, except as provided in this chapter, every contract by which anyone is restrained from engaging in a lawful profession, trade, or business of any kind is to that extent void. So basically they are unlawful. You can't enforce them in the state of California with certain very limited exceptions, but people are still trying it anyway. And as I often see, there are large national companies, maybe international companies, that do one thing in, a state, across the country and expect to be able to do it here too. So, we're seeing, I think, issues that aren't going away, and perhaps efforts to cram down in California what might be lawful somewhere else.
So that led us to the legislative session last year, 2023 legislative session, where several bills were put into the California legislature. It's actually a two-year legislative session, but in the 2023 session, several legislators acknowledged that though we had longstanding statutes on the books saying that non-competition clauses were unenforceable, we're still seeing this happen. I can tell you as a plaintiff's employment attorney, I'm positive this is happening. We're constantly getting calls about it. We're seeing them in new hire documents. We're seeing them in employment handbooks. We're seeing them in separation documents. And even if employees are told these are unenforceable, employees are afraid to do anything about it because they are afraid of the threat letters they get. They're afraid of being forced to hire an attorney. They don't have the money for that, or they don't even know that they read the language and they think it's enforceable. Most people don't have the time or the money to contact an attorney. So they read the language and they think it's enforceable. So there were several pieces of legislation that went through our California legislature in California legislature in 2023, specifically addressing this and bringing it to the attention of California employers and saying, we have to stop this chilling effect. You cannot put this language in your employee documents. And even to that effect, you have to actually tell them that this language is unenforceable.
So the idea of an employer bluffing with their superior resources is something that they attempted to shut down in the legislature. Tom, does it have that effect, do you think?
I think to the extent employers are, paying attention, yes, it does. I mean, I think they're going to want to look at the agreements and they have and to determine, is this within the scope of what the law covers? And then, are we safe in going forward? I think a lot of what employers will do is risk management and, deciding how risk averse they are. But they do, I think, as Beth points out, want that leverage. They want to be able to send that letter, cease and desist from, going into business with our competitor, taking our stuff, or doing the things that an employer would be concerned about. So I think the California law is really, I think, putting some teeth into, making employers take another path, especially with notice requirements.
So rather than bluffing, perhaps the idea of making sure that what you write is enforceable so that you can really reach out and stop somebody.
Exactly.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. And we're asking this week that you join with us, the community at large, join with us. We're here for you. And this program in particular is serving two communities. We bring together two communities to serve you. That is the legal community, people such as Tom and Beth, and many others who come and join us week after week to pass along information to you. And you listeners who listen to us from week after week, call us in from week after week, call in with your questions, and really participate and make the show your own. Now we're asking if the communities would help us keep the doors open, help KALW make a program such as this available to you.
And the number to call is 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917, or online kalw.org to show your support for your legal rights. This is the first day of KALW's spring-summer membership campaign, and we want to get this first day off to a good start. And it would be great if we could convince six of you. That's right, six of you to step forward in support of your legal rights. That's our goal for this hour. Six of you going online at kalw.org or calling us at 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917.
And there's no place else on the web where you're going to get this kind of coverage. We've had such guests as justices of the California Supreme Court. We've had attorneys on various issues. Some are tremendously magnanimous. Some are villainous, up to it, including one facing criminal prosecution in a multitude of states and the architect of former President Trump's efforts to stay in office. You won't hear that kind of content anywhere else. And in fact, we have been rated as one of the top 30 podcast anywhere for non-lawyers. If you're curious about that, go to feedspot.com or simply Google top 30 legal podcasts for non-lawyers. And again, you will only hear this broadcast on KALW.
And the reason why Your Legal Rights was given this award as one of the most popular podcasts in the nation is because for many years, probably over 30 years, Your Legal Rights has been a valuable public service dispensing legal information on a wide variety of topics like landlord-tenant, tax tips, employment and labor law, consumer rights, debtors' rights, and the list goes on and on. Jeff does this entirely on his own as a volunteer. He doesn't get a penny for this work. So please show your appreciation for what Jeff does week after week. 800-525-9917. We're looking for six of you to help us out during this hour of Your Legal Rights. 800-KALW-917 or online kalw.org.
So that brings us back. We were talking about where the law was. What led to some of these statutory changes?
So real quickly, the first one we were just talking about, SB 699, I think what you're asking is that came about as a bill that was submitted by several organizations that advocate on behalf of employees. It was submitted by the Senator Anna Cabrillo, keeping in mind that there was concerns about employees having to address these issues, and it specifically says in the bill that prohibits an employer or former employer from attempting to enforce a contract that is void under the Business Professions Code 16600. Regardless of whether or not that contract is signed. So it was designed to prohibit and limit this conduct and help encourage employees to not worry about the language and limit the restrictions so people start looking for work and encourage positive flow of economy. It gives victims the right to private right of action, seek injunctive relief, actual damages, entitled recovery of attorney's fees and costs as well.
What other statutory changes are underfoot?
There was another one last year. It was Assembly Bill 1076 by Rebecca Barr-Cahan that also codified existing case law, statutory law, that required employers to notify current and former employees by February of this year that non-competition agreements, clauses in their agreements and documents were unenforceable. Furthering the language of and the concept of people have the right to compete, people have the right to get a job, and making sure employees were on notice of that.
How does this differ in California than federally?
Well, federally, I would say that it's sort of a patchwork at this point because it's been regulated by the states until, you know, we've seen some things recently from administrative agencies like the National Labor Relations Board and the Federal Trade Commission, where there have been, I think, different perspectives brought to bear to try to regulate this issue. And, you know, from the Federal Trade Commission in the interest of competition and growth in the economy, and from the National Labor Relations Board perspective, from the growth or from the perspective of employee rights and the ability to ply one's trade and communicate about things.
Right. So the FTC really buckled down, did a lot of analysis, gathering data from all the different government agencies, and drafted proposed regulations about non-competition agreements that they launched in January of 2023. But what they did is they launched them for public comment and feedback, and noting that at that time, they said 1 in 5 Americans, or approximately 30 million Americans, were bound by non-competition clauses. That wasn't just in California, that was throughout the United States. And they said, we have these rules that we want to propose that were similar to California, but actually more restrictive in some areas, which we'll go into in a second. But they opened it for public comment. And they held public comment for many months. They received over 26,000 public comments. That's one of the largest public comment feedbacks the federal government has ever received. Of the 26,000, over 25,000 of them were unilaterally in support of non-competition agreement eliminations. These are just people who wanted to ensure that there was a category ban of non-compete agreements. Within this, it included workers saying that they wanted them blocked so they could have better access to getting jobs, negotiating better pay, and supporting their right to own businesses. The FTC also heard from entrepreneurs and small businesses who said that non-compete agreements prevented them from starting their own ventures and hiring knowledgeable workers to help them grow and start their businesses.
So how do you find a balance? How do you find a balance between not preventing employees from pursuing their livelihood and protecting the employer's rights to not have somebody you trained and brought to the point of perfection going to one of your competitors and saying, neener, neener, everything you know, I now own?
That is a tough one, and it's so detail-driven. Each employee, each workplace will present a different scenario. And you know, the duties that somebody performed, the information that they had access to, the processes and customer lists and you know, all those sorts of things. And not to mention, was the employer really rigorous in what they claim was theirs? And were they truly maintaining confidentiality? And were they truly, trying to protect something that's unique? And a lot also depends on the phrasing of an agreement, a policy. So you could see, different things from company to company. Sometimes I'll see different things within the same company, and it can create some question of consistency. So I think, you know, there's a lot that needs to be looked at. It's hard to draw a bright line.
Are you, and I think that Jeff and Tom, that you're getting to something important is the new FTC rules that came out and now become effective September 4th, 2024, because they were launched and they gave everyone some time to ease into them. And I'll address in a second what they really are. But I think, Jeff, you're asking about also, there's the time that the employer puts into someone, kind of like the time and the effort to train someone versus and make them part of your employee family. There's also the time and effort that you pay to send someone to a training course or education. That's actually quite different. Those are two different things, and the law addresses them differently. If the employer actually pays out of pocket to go to a training course, that the law in every state is a bit different about reimbursement of training courses versus the time and effort to, you know, maximize putting the effort into training employees. And that's just, unfortunately, the cost of doing business. There is no such thing as servitude in any state in the union, in any city or county in California. That is the cost and risk and benefit of doing business, is that you have to onboard an employee. And if you don't onboard them correctly, that's the risk that you have of having untrained employees.
Yeah. And I think employers need to make, you know, good choices, you know, budget wise and, you know, staffing wise, in terms of, you know, what they do, how they train. Is there going to be return on investment? Yeah, there are going to be situations where people leave you. There's no question about it. And I think a lot of the people who are, you know, viewed today as, you know, successful entrepreneurs are people who, you know, maybe bucked the system somewhere and, broke away to do their own thing. And so to say that people, you know, cannot do that can be, you know, somewhat contradictory. But certainly employers want to, I think with good reason, protect themselves to the best of their ability, to protect their company, their product, their service, whatever is unique, and maximize value for shareholders, especially if they're larger organizations. It's a tough call, and it's always hard to lose somebody, but you got to be prepared for that. That's got to be part of your business culture, realizing as successful as you are and as good an employer as you might be, that you still might have people leave.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we're discussing the changing world of labor and employment, in particular looking at non-compete agreements, how it affects employers and employees alike. My guest, Thomas Lenz, a partner at Atkinson Andelson Lawyer Rude Rumu in Pasadena, California, and Beth W. Mora of Mora Employment Law. My guests are both here to help. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, toll-free is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking labor and employment law. We're really focusing on non-compete agreements, but you're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You know, we spoke briefly on the Federal Trade Commission. How about the National Labor Relations Board or the National Labor Relations Act?
And excuse me, I wanted to clarify a few things about the FTC before we jump to the NLRB that we didn't cover that is important for our listeners. Is that, Tom, is that all right?
Absolutely.
Thank you. So the FTC was really expansive. It covered the broad scope. It did a real deep analysis, covered a broad scope of issues for non-competition agreements that in California, we had already addressed a great deal between statute and case law. But what the FTC did, which is great, is they just put it all together in the code. So if anyone wants to, they can actually read position statements on it or code or fact sheets on it. It's really helpful. And what the FTC also says is if you are reading something in the FTC and you are also in a different state, if your state has more employee-friendly laws, the more employee-friendly laws in your state controls. But if the FTC is more employee-friendly on that specific issue, the FTC controls. For California, majority of our statutes and case law are more employee-friendly with the FTC, except for a few areas. And one of those specific areas the FTC covered a little bit more broadly than California is when, and which is also very interesting to California, is that here we have a lot of situations where employers like to make employees small percentage owner, like half a share, two shares, we're making you a partner. And that was a very clever way a lot of employers went to try to get around the non-competition rules. We're not making, you know, we're going to give you this. So if you're selling the business as a business owner, you're selling your goodwill. So it sidesteps the business professions code. California caught on to that, created case law about it, and addressed it. However, the FTC just very clearly said, you have to own a chunk of business. This is, we're not playing this game. And they did analysis around 25%. They look at other percentages, but you need to own this business. You can't just be owning a small percentage and then you're exempt from non-competition rules. And this is actually really important for California because a lot of people start in these small businesses. They get a very small percentage, or they start in these businesses and they get a percentage as like a bonus. So please pay attention to the FTC. They also did a carve out the non-competition clauses for anyone it becomes exempt. All non-competition agreements for employees are now void as of the start date of the clause, or the FTC language is September 4th, but for senior executives. The way they created very clear guidelines under FTC for senior executives, but they expect senior executives to know how to negotiate for themselves and find counsel to help them. But they did clarify what those guidelines are. Those are three things to really keep in mind about the FTC. Anything else, Tom?
I think that it's important to point out that, yeah, where there are exceptions, I think really it comes down to bargaining power. If you are somebody who is at the top rungs of a company and that corporation is going out of business, it's selling, your partnership is splitting up, you know, that's where, you know, you can have some reasonable scope on, I won't compete for X amount of time, I won't operate in a particular market for a limited period of time. And it's a bargaining power thing, but the broad reach of these rules, and both in California and what Beth is talking about with FTC, you know, they're really looking at that ownership group. They're looking at, you know, do you really have sway in terms of the direction of the business, not just the job you do, but where that business is going. And I think that is a huge entrepreneurial distinction that we need to keep in mind.
Right. Are you on the leadership team? Are you on the governing board? All sorts of things, not just the percentage and amount of percentage, but are you a decision maker? It's a great point, Tom.
Yeah, you can't just call me an owner and, you know, give me 1% of shares when I have no say in what happens in the business and then tell me I can't compete. That's the sort of thing that, you know, we need to review with employers as they look at, you know, creating or enforcing such clauses.
So, sorry, I cut you off. You were shifting to the NLRB.
We were shifting to the NLRB. Let's talk about them a little bit.
Absolutely. We've been on in the past talking about NLRB, and, you know, many people think it's a law principally related to unions and unionized workplaces. But I think in the current iteration of NLRB in the Biden administration, there is an emphasis more generally, more broadly on employee rights, concerted activity, the ability to speak and engage in action related to wages, hours, and working conditions. And the National Labor Relations Board came out with a decision in early 2023, McLaren McComb, where it dealt with severance agreements. And it said that restrictions in severance agreements that provided for non-disclosure, non-disparagement of the employer were violations of the National Labor Relations Act. They were not non-compete provisions. However, they energized the general counsel in Washington, D.C., and it wasn't long after that, just a few weeks, that there was a memorandum from the general counsel appointed by President Biden, confirmed by the U.S. Senate, and she really took great interest in challenging non-compete language as an infringement upon employees' rights to discuss wages, hours, and working conditions, and to take action to better their situation in the workplace. So, yeah, this is a live issue under labor law as well as it is under competition law enforced by the FTC. And I think it's important to point out that as these national federal agencies look at these issues, you're looking at perhaps a more consistent legal standard nationally, which could provide clarity, you know, whether you like the direction the rules are going or not. And it's something that will be borne out more as cases are prosecuted and decided by the judges.
Now, from my view, and of course I don't practice in this area, but my expectation is that some of the regulations by some of these agencies may lead to inconsistency at the same time, and where in the sense that they may give far greater consistency from state to state and make it easier for large employers to have operations in different places and not have to face myriad regulations in different of different sorts and stripes. At the same time, these agencies change dramatically when the administration changes, both at the very top and the direction that they're pushing, which brings up the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is federal legislation. I know there was some pending a couple of years ago. What's the current status of the Workplace Mobility Act?
Well, that's a great question. And to that point, actually, we've already seen several challenges to the FTC legislation. The FTC rule. And those challenges, you know, in essence, you'll see a position statement on the FTC website for the new rule saying we have a right as this agency to make this rule because they knew these challenges were going to come up. And Tom's point is right on target. He said early on, this is a Biden administration appointment because Tom's world and National Labor Relations Board, when the administration changes, the rulings just flip. It's been more clear in the last two or three administrations. It's been flip, 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 like a just dramatic flips. And so having consistency with the Workforce Mobility Act would be wonderful because the Workforce Mobility Act is a bipartisan bill. And that's a really important thing for us all to kind of just sit with for a second because we don't get that very often. No matter what's been going on over the last, two or three administrations, there has not been that many bipartisan bills on any subject. But employment, there has been a few. There's been a few, for example, on carving out sexual harassment, sexual assault from forced arbitration. That was a bipartisan bill. And it went through. And it's because of those bipartisan relationships working on legislation that you see movement. And without it, we don't see a lot of movement. So the Workforce Mobility Act was actually introduced first in 2019 and 21. It was reintroduced in 2023, but it was reintroduced just days after, literally 2 weeks after the FTC rule was introduced for public comment. And because of that, it really sat in committee on both sides of the House. And it's been sitting. And the Workforce Mobility Act is, in essence, kind of a mimic of the FTC with some differential. So, for example, the FTC has a 25% ownership rule for shareholders, business owners, whereas the Workforce Mobility Act, I think it was like 5%. It's a lower number, but it's not as high as the FTC. They have some changes, some things that are different, but they're all concept-wise relatively similar. So the Workforce Mobility Act was in essence a confirmation of the FTC, a showing of support. And now that the FTC rule has gone through, we're just waiting to see what's going to happen with the Workforce Mobility Act. I'm hoping that they, in essence, rubber stamp it to give it stability, but it hasn't moved yet again.
You raise an interesting point, Jeff, because if the legislation does not advance and we are facing the regulatory flip-flop between agencies, it does create sort of discontinuities in the rules. The Supreme Court is looking to adjust that. There's a longstanding precedent in a case called Chevron that is being reviewed by the Supreme Court, which might actually affect the ability of agencies to change the rules from one administration to another. And we'll see where that goes. I think if Chevron has changed, we'll simply see more lawsuits, and people will be picking courts to try to get the best judge in order to get the outcome that their side seeks. So,
you mean picking courts more than they already do?
Correct. So it's a different form of flip-flop and inconsistency that will create basically more work for lawyers. I don't know that it'll necessarily clear up the rules.
Seems to me that with what we've seen of late, relying on courts may not be all that helpful. In California, things have been reasonably stable, but in the federal courts, the courts have been far more politicized. The whole process of nominations and getting somebody through, which used to be based on qualifications and now is based more and more on political litmus test or loyalty. It's very disturbing what's happening in that arena, but that's another show. For this show, I'd like
that's
to bring
a good us, show.
That may be a great show to have, but for today, I'd like to circle back for a minute, talk about this station and helping to keep this program and others like it on the air. You know, we're very unique to have the interaction of these communities, one that listens and helps to support the program, makes phone calls and asks questions. Come on, folks, give us phone calls. That's one community. And having the legal community come out and educate and tell people about the laws, about how they can comport their affairs and what guidance the law gives. Very unique, and we look forward to the communities at large to help us and keep this show going.
This is Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff's engineer for Your Legal Rights, and this is the first day of KALW's summer fundraising campaign. And our goal for this hour of Your Legal Rights is six. That's six of you calling us right now at 800-525-9917 and contributing whatever you can. We welcome any and all amounts. And we appreciate whatever you can give us. You can contribute online by going to kalw.org, kalw.org. And Jeff, the good news is we're on a roll. We are over halfway towards reaching our goal. And the bad news is we need two more of you. Two more of you calling 800-525-9917. 800-KALW-917 or online kalw.org. And I have a few people to thank who called in during this past hour. Thanks to Kenise Flanagan from San Francisco. Thanks to Sherwin Chu from Oakland. And thanks to Cheryl Landwehr from Klamath Falls, Oregon. We have listeners all over the place, Jeff.
That's awesome. And you know, the type of thing that you will get on this show and few others, it's going to be summed up in my next couple questions. You want to get legal advice. You want to get guidance on what you can and can't do. And this is where you'll get it. Let me turn it to my guests. Beth, what should employees be doing right now?
Well, employees should have received a notice in February of this year from their current or and former employer advising if they had any non-compete clauses in their agreements and workplace documents, advising that those clauses were unenforceable. If they didn't, they should double check their documents and double check that the employer had the correct contact information, and then look into why they didn't get that communication. And they should stay informed. The point of these recent laws with the California and the FTC was to really help encourage employees feel safe to engage in work and to help encourage economy for everyone. And so employees need to know that they have the right, and these clauses are uninformed. So they need to read their documents, and if they don't feel like they're comfortable doing it, they can ask for help. It is never wrong to ask for help. There is no question that is silly. The only question that's silly is the one you don't ask. Ask for help.
Absolutely. And Tom Lenz, what should employers be doing right now?
Employers should be reaching out to counsel to say, yeah, if you have a non-compete or something that's going to restrict your former employees, get it reviewed, especially if you've been using some sort of master document, some template that somebody drafted decades ago. You want to get that reviewed, updated. You want to scrap something that's going to be violative of today's standards. Recognize that the law is constantly evolving, and change is a constant when we're dealing with these sorts of issues. So talk to your lawyer, revise things, and you should be candid with your lawyer about what it is that is unique and important to you, so that you can do your best to protect it, and also be aware of where there are potential pitfalls, where you might be overreaching. The deadline to send those notices out that Beth was talking about was perhaps not coincidentally Valentine's Day. So, maybe you got a Valentine, and maybe you also, got a letter from your employer saying, that thing we made you sign, we think it's illegal, it's void, and so you're not bound by it anymore. But you should have done that. You may want to talk to somebody if you haven't done that already. And I realize that a lot of employers are with different levels of risk aversion. Some people are going to want to really tread a straight line and not have any risks of this sort. Others are going to want to be really aggressive and take their chances. And there's going to be a lot of folks from outside of California who come here to do business because, regardless of what people say, we have a vibrant economy where people want to be, and I will bang that drum as long as I'm allowed to. California is awesome. That's why people are here. But you got to recognize, if you're going to play in our sandbox, you have to know the rules and live by them, and educate your management team so that everybody's on board. Then law firms like mine, like many others, have educational programs and updates to make sure that as the law evolves, that you learn about it. And I'm also, if I have a moment, going to plug the California Lawyers Association Labor and Employment Law section, because that is where lawyers like Beth and I have programs, educational programs, to get the word out on things like this, so that people can stay out of trouble and keep it at an advice level rather than going to court.
And just to be clear, the California Lawyers Association isn't just sending lawyers to programs like this and educating the public. You're the folks that do a lot of the education of the lawyers themselves, so that when you walk into a law office where the attorney you're talking to is a member and an active member of the California Lawyers Association, you probably have someone who's more educated in their craft than many others, most others.
Yes, we try. We do a lot of education. We have conferences coming up in July, and the goal is to make a safe space for plaintiffs' attorneys, defense attorneys, neutrals, government attorneys, all to come together and educate together. So it's not a one-sided education. It's for everyone to get on the same page and understand the process, understand the law, understand the cases, so we can do this together. I do want to point out that as plaintiff's attorney as I am, and as much as I believe non-competition agreements shouldn't be in place, that the FTC did a wonderful study pointing out how much this helps everyone. So take your time and look at the FTC website. They have a great fact sheet. And some of the California legislation did this as well in the Workforce Mobility Act. It really pointed out how limiting non-competition agreements increases wages, decreases costs of physician services in the healthcare, increases business services and business innovation, all of these and multiple different factors about, and it will help businesses. It will help reduce costs, increase productivity, increase wages. It flows into the economy in a positive way for everyone. Doesn't just help the employee. It helps the employer. It helps the businesses that serves the employer. It's just waves upon waves of positive reinforcement. It may be changed, maybe scary, but it ultimately will have a real positive outcome.
We have a couple minutes left. Let me turn it over to Lee from Albany. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for joining us.
Where were you where was your show when I was growing up? I guess I moved away from KLAW, and I missed some important things in my education, especially around the law. Can Mara say more about physicians and how non-compete agreements affect physicians, affect the ability of physicians to give health care, and just an open question, non-compete clauses and physicians?
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised. Thanks for calling in, because you point out something extremely important. I'm not at all surprised that there's a question about this. The FTC presentation, when they launched the new rules, actually, and it's still, the recording still exists on the FTC website, specifically talked about the immense amount of feedback they received from physicians and their shock. And the members of the FTC board commission, several of them commented about their shock of the restrictive covenants placed on doctors, many of them telling just job-dropping stories of having to move out of state to find jobs because the restrictive covenants placed on them were so horrific. And that's in light of COVID, when so many doctors were leaving jobs and they couldn't find doctors to staff hospitals, and they needed help, desperately needed help, and these restrictive covenants were in place, and doctors were forced to move their families, leave their jobs, move their kids from schools. You do see pretty intense restrictive covenants in place in hospital systems. I don't know why there's such a history of it, but it's just every industry, you see it in the car industry, sales industry. Some industries have long-standing restrictive covenants, and the FTC rules were very shocked when they were drafting this, and they addressed it overtly.
Could I answer your question? Do you know why the American Medical Association was founded?
I try not to comment overtly, but go ahead.
Oh, my bad. Well, I'll tell you. So the American Medical Association, I believe it was founded in 1895 or a little later, was founded in response to competition from midwives, homeopaths, chiropractors, osteopaths, and actually homeopaths were doing so well, the American Homeopath Association, that the AMA only had mercury, leeches, and laxatives, and they needed to shore up being a doctor. And it's been abused now, and I'll just offer one thing. You may not know this, but the number of physicians committing suicide successfully per year, I believe, is now at 400. There's a link between losing your job and your dignity and everything you have. There's also a harm to patients that lose that doctor. One such doctor is Dr. Jay Neufeld in, I believe it's Idaho. He was the only pediatric rehab doctor for the entire state, and he committed suicide. So I would offer that, you know, like what Nancy Pelosi says, we do it for the children, right? Jay took care of disabled children, the only pediatric rehab doctor in the entire state. So I think, just like Magnus Hirschfeld, just like the Austrian Jews, we should pay attention when Timothy Snyder talks about, what is it, anticipatory obedience, and people start committing suicide in an anticipatory fashion, like Austria, or physicians, because of what they're facing at work and with medical boards, start attempting suicide because of the restrictions on their freedom. On these, I forgot when you said restrictive covenant, put me right back into, you know, the restrictive covenants for Jewish people, for African Americans, and physicians have a covenant to first do no harm and take care of their patients. And I would, but maybe that should be a right, you know, some sort of basic human right that.
Well, Lee, I don't want to cut you short, but we are out of time for the night, and I would invite you to come back another time. I'm very interested in what you're starting and the conversation that we would be about to have, but unfortunately, I have to cut it short because we're out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing the changing world of non-compete agreements and how it affects employers and employees alike. Our guests tonight have been Beth W. Mora of Mora Employment Law and Thomas Lenz, a partner at Atkinson Andelson, Lawyer Rood and Romo in Pasadena. A former president faces prosecution. His rival has an interest in seeing a successful prosecution while overseeing the government, including the Department of Justice. The prosecution of Donald J. Trump. Join us in Early Lights next week, Wednesday at 6, when we'll take your calls and answer your questions about that prosecution. A big thanks to tonight's guest and to the Labor and Employment section of the California Lawyers Association. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.